Hello.
Hi, Joanne.
Ruben, hi.
How's it going?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Does my phone work better speaking to you directly like this, or by speaker? Sometimes my audio, I think they tell me it's muffled.
I think if you just keep speaking directly, it's better.
Okay.
I found headphones and other apparatus sometimes interfere with the device, with the app I use. Are you comfortable with that?
Yes, I'm totally
fine. Good.
Good.
It's been a long time. Happy to speak with you, and I want to thank you very much. I know how busy you are. So this is precious 45 minutes, and I'm appreciative. Thank you.
No, thank you. I'm honored to be part of it. I really thank you. I appreciate it as well.
How are the children? I just so love watching them on Instagram.
Oh, they're great. They're good. They've been healthy, so it's been awesome. You know, our little ones constantly had health issues, so we've really hunkered down during the sheltering in place, the gallery, and now the hospital, the second building I've entered since March, to pick up some medicine for them.
Yeah. How have you all managed during this time?
We're hanging in there.
Yeah.
No.
Are you both still able to work?
I've been, we went to teaching remotely from, Cam usually assists me in the studio, so the studio was, we're between projects, or I'm working on a few public commissions, so
mm-hmm.
I've been able to hire, it's in another state, so I've been able to hire workers over there to, a fabricating company to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But teaching, I've been teaching and, doing drawings here and there and working on a few concepts and ideas. But once the shutdown happened, all the teaching went remote, and Cam just stayed mostly with the kids. When I was teaching, she would help school them and do remote learning with them for kindergarten and for first grade and preschool.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of work on she did an amazing job, but it was really taxing. And, I've been able to finally get into do some studio work in the last 2 weeks. But part of it was also how do you produce in these times? It's like, how do you just think I'm going to make art? And with the pandemic, with the uprising, it was just quite challenging to just sit there and want to make art, thinking about all the things going on.
Yeah, you're conflicted, and yet your work speaks directly to so much of the controversy.
Right.
I was thinking, in anticipating talking to you, your work seems more timely now than ever in recognizing these big divides. And the
definitely.
Weight of all of it.
No, definitely. And it's, and that's where actually I think even being a professor right now, School of Art, for USC Rossi School of Art has been really also part of my, role. Also, I really push to impact culture and address these social inequities. And now I see students and emerging artists, students just graduated that are doing that and tackling a lot of these issues, and we're having dialogues or just witnessing what they're doing is amazing to see, to be a part of that too.
And you like to be active on the scene too, I think, correct?
Oh yeah, yes. I just couldn't physically go out there and protest because of my son, but
mm-hmm.
and I think that's how my latest piece of the gallery came about. Was like, I'm going to do one big protest art, and it's going to be a protest piece, and it's going to be big.
And it is, and it was successful. I love it.
Thank you.
It looks great. I wanted to just explore, I want to go back and find out more about your history and how you came to this time and this work that you produce. When did art first enter your life, do you think?
I would say as a kid, I always would draw. don't know where I, you know, my mom would show me how to draw, like, dogs and nose. Try to, you know, I was always into drawing, so she would just try to encourage it. And from a young age, I actually got really supportive instructors and teachers that would saw that I was interested in drawing and making art, so they would give me free paper or note cards, colored note cards to draw over the summer to create stories and drawings. And they've always were really supportive. I'd make my own comic books in third and fourth grade of a Mexican homeboy called Paco. And he would be dealing with issues of race. You know,
really?
Yeah, as I think about it, I'm like, oh, I wish I still had those.
And you don't have them?
No, those are, I think those got tossed away at some point.
Oh, no.
I probably didn't clean up, and they probably got put into something that my mom probably told me, let her go hello, and I didn't pick it up, and I don't know. I they were so long.
Isn't it interesting? How old were you when you were producing these?
These were, I would say, fourth grade for sure, fourth, fifth grade,
uh-huh.
And it was a whole series of this local neighborhood guy named Paco who had like a gang club, but wasn't really about the negative side. I mean, they'd get in fights with other rival street gangs, but a lot of it was addressing about like seeing the racial tensions happening, even where I grew up in Oceanside, even though there was a lot of different ethnicities in the neighborhood, people, you know, we would still congregate and hang out, but people would also self-segregate. So I think that was all reflected.
Maybe you need to resurrect them.
Right. I know. So I think there's so many great comic book artists now that are touching upon that. That's where a lot of my drawings was inspired.
Well, it's wonderful that you found that avenue to kind of express your lived experiences, a way to process what you were seeing and feeling.
Yes. Hmm.
And you don't have any images of any of them either, huh?
No, I don't. I mean, I didn't start documenting my work until high school when a high school art teacher said, you get taught me how to document and explain how. I think he saw my portfolio once. It was all ragged and beat up. And he said, you got to document your work before it gets to this point.
So when did you transition from, what happened? How did you transition from the comic book work?
Oh, I mean, I think it's something that, you know, as a kid, you're just constantly drawing what's around you. I would draw things on TV, cartoons, Ninja Turtles, ninjas, when ninjas were really big in the mid-80s. And then to G.I. Joe. I did an artist talk, and I pulled up images of the Dreadnoughts. The Dreadnoughts are this, like, subgroup of the Cobra. The G.I. Joe, who's a military all-American, and then there's Cobra, who's the sinister people, but then you had a subgroup they'd have called the Dreadnoughts, and they were from New Zealand, I believe. But I remember I was really fascinated with these characters, and I started drawing my own characters and I would think about this, and I started thinking about it within this last year and a half, is like, these are like the first characters I saw that I would recognize and have a relationship with them, in the sense that they looked like construction workers, and they looked like my dad and my dad's friends and my uncle. They had denim jeans, even though all their weapons were like power tools converted to like weapons of destruction.
Uh-huh.
I was like really fascinated. Like, I would constantly draw them and try to create other characters and other vehicles that looked like everyday vehicles, but with machine guns and whatnot.
Wow. And they're gone too?
All those drawings, yeah.
Oh, Lord. That makes me sad. But it's interesting that you began to think about, pay more close attention to construction and construction workers and the tools, because obviously that's become the medium for you.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's something that my parents kept me away from, you know, people working construction. I mean, we helped with the family business. I mean, my parents are both, you know, it's a mix of both labor and informal economy. My mom started a whole tortilla delivery business that was really informed a good part of my practice on how to just create these interventions and how to engage a space. And then the labor side is just, a lot of it's just reflecting on this invisible labor that I see, you know, happening around Southern California with my dad, my uncle, my cousins, family members.
You're really comfortable with all of that material.
I have. I mean, but some of it also was ill familiar, but I also didn't know the language. I had to learn it because it was something that my parents kept us away from wanting to pursue construction work. I mean, I think they just wanted us to do, to be fine, and as long as we didn't get into trouble, they were good. I mean, if we ended up going to do construction, that was fine, but they just wanted to, I mean, they were just surprised when I finally, when I decided to go to school, go pursue, and then pursue a degree in art. They were like, okay.
And when did you decide that? When did that happen?
That was right out of high school. I was, you know, always, I was taking art classes, and I had a really instrumental professor who I'm still in touch with, my high school art teacher, George Papsek. He, we share the same birthday, so we call each other every year. He pulled me aside my senior year and said, really thought I could get a scholarship and pursue getting an art degree. And we see all these art colleges come to school and talk about, you know, Otis Art College, Art Center, and the tuition. And we're, all of us were, friends would be like, oh, we're never going to make go there. It's too expensive. But he really pushed me to get a scholarship. And I dug down and worked at it and was able to get a scholarship to help pay for some of the schooling. And that's how I ended up going to pursuing the arts.
What were you producing when you were a senior in high school?
I was actually producing stuff. It was really about identity politics. It was really engaging with my identity as a Mexican-American growing up in Southern California, growing up in Oceanside. We do a self-portrait, and I would draw myself and then being harassed by the Border Patrol in the background. I would draw a lot of Mexican motifs or Mexican-American motifs. It was something that, I was recognizing that there wasn't a lot of positive or many too many role models or any indication that being Mexican was good. So I was just trying to draw that and come across that and try to learn that. I mean, we'd take literature classes, and the literature classes would be telling us how Pancho Villa was a bandit, how he was bad, and I'd be like, wow, I remember family members telling Pancho Villa was good for people. And so so those are some of the things I was drawing. And also addressing the gang warfare that was occurring. It was on the rise in the early 90s.
Well, it seems like you were acutely aware of what was going on in these communities and the racism that you were witnessing and experiencing yourself was really present to the forefront of your mind coming out in your work.
I mean, it was. I mean, I think I just drew what was around me. I would draw and address what was around me.
Was there a transformative moment for you in contributing to what your work has become?
You mean like currently the work the way it is now?
Well, when I think about where your work is now and listening to where it came from, how did you come to, you were doing a lot of drawing mostly, I assume?
Oh, yes.
And so where did the sculpture enter? When did sculpture enter?
Oh, yes. I would say that would be, I guess, undergrad. You know, I was always, I guess when I was drawing, I was always drawing space and creating 2D areas of space, whether they're neighborhoods or backdrops. But when I took a sculpture class in, I want to say my sophomore year at Otis College, it really blew me away because I actually got to work with the tools that I would see my dad working with or my brother working with. And it just opened up a whole new avenue. Like I felt like the work was already leaving the canvas, was already leaving the walls. And that just allowed me to, it just gave me permission to just run with it.
Well, the objects of your observation, suddenly you were holding them and creating them, and you brought them to 3D, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and because I was, even when I was painting, I was adding collage and objects and found objects, and they're becoming somewhat sculptural on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But once I took that sculpture class, it just allowed me to just break into like volumetric space.
You kind of found your voice, maybe.
Yes, I think so.
And where did photography fit into all of this? Because you do that as well.
I mean, photo was just a way of just constantly documenting and mm-hmm. taking reference shots, taking pictures. When I was an undergrad, the way I ended up going to school was once I graduated high school, I went to community college for a year to take a lot of the liberal studies classes. And so when I was at Otis, I could just really focus on art courses and art electives. And when I was there, I would take video, photo, printmaking, everything I could that would allow me within the range of my credits. And so I really enjoyed photo. My family, my uncle had a really nice Nikon camera. We would always post for photos, and it was always a thing. My mom has the living room, the bedrooms all decked out with family photos. It's more like just portraiture in that sense. So
mm-hmm.
it was always there. But to realize it, to understand it as a tool to document and even to make art, I think also was eye-opening to understand it in undergrad and to utilize that as my work too.
Drawing plays a very specific role in your studio practice. Can you tell me about that?
I think it's just my go-to. I've always drawn and felt comfortable drawing. And even when I'm working on making sculptures, whether it's bending rebar or twisting rebar, I feel like I'm drawing in space. I'm really trying to engage in the space. And I think all of the fundamentals I've learned for producing work has been built around drawing, like from value, line weight to composition and how you break up space. And when I start to enter into a gallery space, like for a solo show, I start to consider like how this would look as a drawing, how will the composition break up the space, how do I create these own viewing points, and then how to adjust the weight in the space, you know, whether there's an object lower to the ground that gives it more weight or something higher. Or in between. I think I always just look at it in that sense.
And how do you keep these drawings that you're creating that help you idealize the sculptures or the installation work? What happens to that work?
I do have a lot of sketches. I guess I would always draw a sketch. But there was also probably grad school was where realizing that these sketches, these drawings, these doodles, or even like these reference shots of photos mm-hmm. could actually be the work too. I don't mm-hmm. have to make that final masterpiece. I don't have to segue. Like it doesn't have to be this finished product. Everything in between could be the work itself. And
right.
I think that was really really, really compelling for me to recognize. And I think that's where my work also started to become more looser and to incorporate. Especially like in figure drawing, you always think of, oh, there's no mistake. You just keep drawing and drawing and you don't erase. I really started to apply that in all the work and from the drawings I make to the sculptures. And then if the sketch is a if I'm doing a sketch, then that may end up becoming just a final piece too. It might just, mm-hmm. it might look a little rough. It might look a little, it'll be incorporated just as loose as a, sorry, I lost my train of thought. It'd be more like a, it may look like a sketch because it probably was a working sketch that became just a little more developed as a, mm-hmm. as a drawing.
And what do you do with all of this? I mean, do you is this all organized in books or individual sheets of paper, scraps, and what happens to it? Do you keep an archive of all these drawings? Sketches?
Yeah, I'm going to go on that show at Hoarding, on the show of Hoarders.
Oh, music to my ears. Thank you, thank you.
I do have a lot of these sketches and drawings and notebooks and scraps, pieces of paper, tissue. And then I do try to collect it. I've been trying to photograph it too so I could keep in mind, like, because, sometimes you're sketching and doodling, whether if I'm developing a sculpture and I'm thinking, if this post I'm going to build and this rebar structure, try to work it out wherever you're at if I have a notebook on me. And then I try to take snapshots of it so I could go back to it or put it on the computer. In the end, I just have more images and got to figure where I looked that up and file that. But I do have a lot of makeshift portfolios that I have of sketches and drawings. I try to keep it archival, but
is it organized? Is it like in chronological order, or is there a structure in the way that you store it?
Not that organized, but it's
uh-huh.
I roughly know where things are at. Uh-huh. I do have I do try to put the flat work with flat work, but it's not by year or chronology. I don't have a drawing file.
I see.
Put them in flat portfolios and stuff them in there.
And is it all different kinds of paper and different sizes? Or is there order to what you go to in terms of the size or the materiality?
Usually when in the process, yes. But then if I go back to like a year or two later to like look at mm-hmm. something or reference something, then I just mess up that order.
mm-hmm. Well,
like right now I have a
workspace okay.
and everything's all like on a table mixed up and not everything's great. Everything's just some of just notes and phone numbers and there's a drawing next to it.
But it's all got meaning one way or another. It all fits together.
Right.
Curious. If you look back at the work that you produced since college, what would you say are the common threads to your artistry that have continued to develop from the early stages?
Good question. I've been thinking about it a lot too. With everything going on with the uprising and seeing the energy and the synergy all happening right now and reflecting and getting that flame, like, inspired by it again. Like, I would say just this constant notion to, like, I guess to impact culture in a sense as an artist of color, as a person of color, like, how do you affect culture and change? And if I could do that with my work, I try that, if I could do that by exposing or making work that either pays tribute or even just questions or investigates and shows others, shows people possibly like a new way of looking at things, a different perspective of whether it's labor, class, invisible labor, I guess in that sense. And that's what I grew up knowing and seeing. And to be able to see that in the gallery or museum wall is, when I saw the muralists and the work of the Mexican muralists, even Chicano artists, like, it was far and few when I would see that growing up. But when I did, it was really amazing. Like, and then now that my work is, I guess, being exhibited and shown, and to hear students are whether they're art majors or not, see my work and how that impacts them.
Your work really does impact a person's physicality. At least all the work that I've seen really has an impact on my body.
Right.
The materiality and the weight and the way that you play with scale and deceive with weight is confounding.
Well, thank you. I really do try to push. I mean, it's an object. It's the form, and you have to engage with it. It's a bit different than a work on the wall. I'm negotiating space, and I want the viewer to negotiate the object and the space together, like, and maybe activate it, whether they have to dodge it, like crouch down to either avoid it or engage with it. You know, I think for me that activates the piece. It makes the viewer implicit, you know, as part of the experience.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting when I'm in New York and I walk the streets and walk through construction sites, it always takes me to your work, you know, with the rebar and the concrete and all of the materiality. And I'm very aware of the nature of that material. And, I mean, sometimes I'm nervous walking in amongst these construction sites and feeling that weight. And you take that same idea but transform it in a way that invites us to engage in a safer way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I've had institutions put out waivers. They've had viewers do that. Or they've stood there, put cones in case they felt a few things were a little too, I guess, worrisome. I think I do try to tackle a lot of that. And a lot of it is also just a lot of these materials, one, they're cheap. They're everyday materials. I could come across in any local hardware store. But it's also that and the labor is the foundation that builds a lot of these communities. And you see like these high rises or even these structures built by these everyday materials and invisible labor, I think is what some of the inequities I try to address in the work, like exposing mm-hmm. it, bringing
right.
it into the gallery space or the museum space.
Right. I want to talk to you about there's humor and play in your work. Can you comment on that?
Sure. I hope I'm funny. I try to be funny. I enjoy, I think it's just a byproduct of growing up around family and friends that were always clowning around. My family would say it's very like Mexican, like they have like this Mexican humor, sometimes dark humor, but it's, you're always just, I mean, things are serious, but you got to find a way to laugh at things. And I always was drawn to comedians, especially comedians that would address social inequities through humor. And I always thought that was a nice way to disarm. And then,
mm-hmm.
the same way like sci-fi does it, like for Twilight Zone or even like Dave Chappelle,
mm-hmm.
he would just address these really serious issues, but through humor or through sci-fi. And that just... I think if I gravitate towards that, and if my work could do that, if I could try to address a serious subject but through humor, and but it's still there as an aspect or a layer of it, then awesome.
Well, it's always the other side of it, you know. It's a sort of a dichotomy because there is the almost brutal nature of the material sometimes, but then the way that you play with it and create with it, the humor is a part of that somehow.
Right, yes. I mean,
so
yes.
I mean, you have to stop, and it stops you in your steps, and you look at it, and you're very serious, and suddenly you can be transformed to a lightness of a kind. And it's subtle, but and effective, I think.
Wow, thank you. That's awesome.
You know, the palette piece that I bought, the rubbing, the frottage, the tall palette. I mean, my dad was a construction worker. My dad, blue collar, a lot of construction. So I grew up with cement and dirt and rocks and stone and sand. He would dig foundations, and I knew rebar. But a part of him also, he worked in a 7-Up plant as part-time at night, where he moved the pallets around in the storage, and he had the forklift truck and would move these stacks of pallets all around with big crates of Coke or whatever was in them. And, you know, the pallet piece, when I saw it, just spoke to me on so many levels. And, I mean, I think that's a perfect example of what we were just talking about.
It is. I do try to that's very compelling to hear. I mean, you've told me how your dad would work with pallets. And
oh, I've told you that story. Okay.
Well, you didn't tell me the whole story. You told me aspects that your dad would work with pallets. And it was, but to hear everything, it actually was giving me goosebumps right now. To hear the whole story, like the details, it's like I got goosebumps in my arms. It's like, it's beautiful. I mean,
well, I'm so comfortable with your work because the material, I know it. So I love cement, and so I'm comfortable with it. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is the engineering. I mean, you must have an engineering degree.
No, I wish.
Because the work requires so much engineering. At least it appears that it requires engineering.
I'd probably be living it up if I had an engineering degree. No, I'm kidding. I work, you know, I mean, once you learn how to build something, it's a matter of just trying to take those things. I mean, there's certain things we have gotten engineers through the museum institution. But usually they just come to me and say, hey, do you know how to build this? And I've had an assistant, a fabricating assistant, who's been really good at assisting me in how to build and figure things out. A lot of it's just, if we construct it, we overbuild it. You know, I would make sure it will stand in as many ways as possible. I think when I did Site Santa Fe, when I cut out their floor and pulled out the rebar.
Yeah, that was amazing.
And I had the rebar in the slabs. And, you know, I kept letting them know I need to bring my team in. And they were, you know, it was at budget. Most of the budget was going to go back to repair the floor. So they had their preparators assist me. But you know, they didn't know the language of rebar bending and drilling in that sense. They could install amazing shows, but they didn't know the construction language. So I had to bring in my cousins who work in rebar. So I flew them in to assist. And when they got there, they were just like, I don't know, Prima, I don't think we could do this. And I was like, what? I go, come on, I brought you guys in. We're going to do this. And I think we just talked about, like, in a sense, like, you know, we have like a slab that weighs 500 pounds. If we could support it like a table, you know, with four legs, then, you know, it'll be solid. Each rebar, the tensile strength for it could support 60 pounds. And if we add more and more rebar, then we could dissipate, you know, the weight of 500 pounds to, you know, if there's six rebar on one side or another six rebar on the other side, then that, you know, I was just doing the math that way. And then if we fan out the legs, then we could really catch the pitch and yaw of the piece, and it should be fine. And it was. We did it. So sometimes we're figuring things out in the studio in that sense like that, or on site. And other times when it's just, we got to involve a crane, then we do reach out to an engineer.
Are there any new materials creeping into your practice? I mean, you've got rebar, you've got chain link fence, you've got fence posts and cement, of course.
I think rebar. I haven't. Trying to think. Just new material. I mean, I did do a porcelain rebar sculpture, and then I did do. I've done some steel sculptures that are painted. Oh, I actually, I guess I could let you know. I'm working on a commission for Miami-Dade, which is crazy hot spot right now for the pandemic. But it's going to be a towering polished aluminum pallets sculpture.
Oh, fantastic.
So it's going to tower about 16, 17 feet over about 40 pallets. This is how you normally stack them in the yard. And it's going to be aspects of it polished, some not polished. And it's going to be near the Carrie Meeks Foundation. She was a local senator there, that local, activist, I believe, community organizer, and the foundation there. So that was scheduled to be.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Been working on it for the last couple of years. So I guess aluminum, I haven't worked with aluminum too much, but for a public piece.
But and I, talk I, about I did, doing public commissions. Because you're doing more and more of that, it seems.
This will be my second one I'm doing.
It's only your second public art?
Yeah, second public, like official, like public. I mean, I've done public interventions. Public interventions.
Okay, I guess that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
I mean, I've always been interested in doing public intervention. Before going to the gallery world, I would do works outside of the art scene, outside of the art world. I mean, the White Cube was always like a contentious space for artists of color. We wouldn't show a lot of our artists of color. And so I would always try to make work outside of the space. When I saw that...
Was the Freeway piece then done in that vein?
Yes, the Freeway piece was done how to actually create to remove a section of the freeway wall. It's like, how do I do that? And part of it was to just go and do it in somewhat of an intervention manner. I ended up getting a grant for it, and I looked at so many ways of how to do this without going through all the proper channels. And in the end, the wall was over 25 feet tall, and I couldn't imagine trying to scale it at night and create this wallpaper, because the idea was to remove a section of the wall, and I knew Caltrans would never... The organization would never give me permission to remove a section of the freeway wall, so I thought of like maybe conceptually like creating a conceptual earthwork on paper. So I'd print it on wallpaper as if a section was removed, and then wallpaper the wall, the freeway wall. And in the end, the scale of it and the safety issues, like I was like, this is too risky. We'll have to. Contact the city and go through the cultural affairs and to get permission, because I had the funding from the Creative Capital Foundation to do the project.
So what's the difference between the intervention and a public art commissioned work? I mean, is it just the structure of the... I'm not sure I understand the difference.
There's a couple of things. There's the formal technical aspects of public intervention and public commission to even the politicalness of it, of like just going to intervene in public space, creating a mark and doing it without any permission, almost very like punk, almost like tagging, like you're going to do it. And,
I see. Almost underground kind of.
Yeah, almost underground in that sense. And for me, it has a lifespan. The intervention is going to have a lifespan. It's not there to be permanent. You go and do the piece, and it exists as long as the public, I guess, allows it to. Where a public,
so it's vulnerable.
It's vulnerable, and for me, I welcome that dialogue. Like when I did the furry wallpaper piece, I had to get permission by the city district, by the cultural affairs, and Caltrans that oversee the freeway. I had to get submit this whole graffiti abatement plan. And for me, I wanted that conversation with the community, and if I didn't have a plan in place, they would remove my piece. Because they think anything that goes up here in L.A. gets bombed right away, gets tagged on.
Uh-huh.
That piece, no one touched it for a number of weeks, for like almost a month and a half, no one touched it. And I would say it's a testament to the community that they appreciated it. You know, they really liked it. Because if they don't like it, they'll go and start tagging it. Where the public commission is a either nominated, you're invited. It's a body, like a jurying body, or a committee or group that's deciding on what public art is going to go for permanence.
And you have to submit a proposal and.
Yes, and they're usually the constituents that represent the community. Like they're supposed to have the communities back in. So.
Okay, I understand now.
Yeah.
We're running out of time, and I wanted to ask you another question. And this is, you have these two magnificent children who have entered your life. I want to know how it's affected your artistry.
Oh, wow. I mean, I think I'm just in awe of what they're doing. And I mean, just, I'll send you a picture after this, but
okay, please.
I got home and Jasper's whole body is like covered in markers.
In markers?
Yeah. I think they're just, how has it affected me? I mean,
it's such a big part of your life now, and I can't imagine it hasn't entered your work or your process in some way.
It would.
The idea of that innocence and that freedom of childhood.
No, it does, and I think I'm still understanding it. I know what it has done when I, prior to having my eldest from Jasper to having Emmett, I think it's given me more focus and attention to my time and what, before the projects would just continue and there'd be no end in sight until I just got the work done. Now I got to be more conscientious of like, all right, this is the time I need to do this and factor those things in because, you know, I got to be there for my family. But I also continue to want to just have play in the work as well. And I think my first public commission for the San Isidro Land Port of Entry probably is a reflection of having play, thinking of my childhood, because I have children with me now and what they might experience and what they might see compelling at their age. So I made these large concha marcadores that mark the Mexican pan dulce. And the colors are very playful, and I would say that's really impacted me and how to keep playing my work. Because they love coming to the studio with me. They couldn't all the time because I had concrete and rust and, you know, all kinds of unsafe things for kids around. But they do like going to the shows, and of course they like climbing on my work. So I guess still trying to keep that notion of play in the work, whether it's through titles or humor, but physically if you can as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to see all of you again. I miss you, but I am delighted to be able to see the children in action, and they are funny. They're very funny.
They're characters.
Yeah, they seem to be.
From their mom.
Well, I could talk to you much longer, but I need to let you go. I promised you 45 minutes, and I'm going to try and adhere to that. I thank you for allowing me to intrude on your life and for letting me probe. I'm fascinated by your work. I enjoy watching it continue to progress, and I'm eager to see the next, whenever that will be. I mean, Suzanne's latest is wonderful. Of course, I'm always looking to see what's on paper.
Right, yeah. there's something coming, there's something coming.
Well, you promised to let me know?
Yes. Actually, I'm in the works of it. We actually are going to be doing a garden conversation next week, I think.
Are you?
For this piece. Well, she calls it a garden talk. But it's online.
I've been watching some of those.
Yeah.
And so is that going to be featured?
Um, If I get the drawings done by then, I'll be featured. If not, shortly after.
And what are they?
They're related to the piece, to the hashtag FTP.
Oh, I need to see them. Promise you will show them to me.
Yes, definitely.
Because I looked at those really closely and I went, is this paper that he's applying to the wall? And I'm just trying to figure out what it was. And then I saw that you carved out the wall. And so I guess I can't think about that. But I love what you did. It's wonderful. One of these days I have to get out and see her new space. It's great for your work, isn't it?
It is. It is. I've been doing a few projects here and there in her space. I want to say before you go, like, no intrusion at all. I appreciate your support. I'm honored that you wanted to interview me. You've been really supportive all these years, and it's just thank you. You know, I can't help but thank you and my family. You know, you've supported us, so it's really amazing.
Well, it's the pleasure of my life is knowing artists and specifically meeting you and your family and spending some time with you in Denver have produced great memories and great joy. So hopefully it'll happen again. Please give them my love. And I'll look for you next week in the garden.
Okay, Joanne, have
okay,
a good
take
one.
Take care. Thank you, Ruben. Be well.
Call me if you need to talk about anything or if you need a redo on this interview.
Okay.
Just kidding.
All righty. No, I like these kind of casual and loose. This is perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Bye.